back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Now, if there is support for Māori out there, my personal belief is in volunteerism. For example, I've filmed a number of and interviewed a number of Māori activists and tried to help them get the word out about their various causes, the struggles of their hapū and so on and so forth. That's how I contribute in my own way to the success of Māori. I don't take from other people and give to anybody else what I'm not willing to give up myself. Is there a disconnect and perhaps a lack of community motivation to help Māori directly, perhaps because they're being forced to do it instead of being asked?
Well, yes, I think that people don't like to be forced, especially on false pretenses, when they know that the facts are not being presented properly. I don't think there is any, I don't know any racists. I certainly know I'm not one. The people that are accused of being racist, I think, are well-meaning. People like Martin Dutre lived among Maori, got his information about the Celtic New Zealand, which is a bad choice of word, really, but the pre-Maori people, he got that from the Komatua that he lived among. He's a very warm man, and he is well-disposed towards Maori. So am I. I want to see them do well. I just happen to come from that sort of right-wing thing. It's like if it's a difference between a soft mother and a tough dad, if you like. Now, I think you can argue that a strong dad, not a violent one, a strong dad is a pretty good parent when it comes to it. He doesn't choke his kids with sweets. And that's what your sort of right wing in politics, if you like, is saying. It's still love. It's just a tougher love, and it's saying, look, you don't get anywhere by lying around on welfare.
One would argue
turn up for a job, you know, that sort of thing. That's another kind of love, but it's still love.
One would argue, John, that one needs both a soft mother and a hard father.
Yes.
And at the moment, the government is depriving not just Māori but everybody. Of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if a kid says, can I have a box of chocolates? The easy thing to do is say, oh, yeah, sure, because you'll love me and you'll think I'm wonderful. You may not in 10 years' time when when your teeth have fallen out. Yeah, there needs to be carrot and stick. There needs to be compassion. And, you know, we live in essentially a socialist society where people, we're more than anywhere else on earth probably, people do get money for falling into hard times. It's just a question of degree of money and, you know, how much is enough.
Can I ask? Joe, I think your speakers are up a bit loud there, but it was feedback. Joe, I was wondering, where does the disconnect happen here? Because I see that there is a racism problem in New Zealand. Anybody who knows New Zealand knows that there is at least a little bit of racism out there. I've got cousins from up north. Bro, trust me, they're racist. And it exists. It's a very real thing. I'm wondering, where's the disconnect? When does it stop being a racial thing, and when does it start being a political ideology thing? Because I noticed that the two people here debating whether or not to socialise help for Māori, one happens to be from a left-wing party, and one has rather right-wing views. Is there a disconnect, or are they one and the same?
Yes, Vinny, there is a disconnect. Part of the reason that stems from the racism of New Zealand is the false histories that are being portrayed by people like Martin Dutre. Now, the foremost expert in the New Zealand wars is James Balich. He wrote the New Zealand Wars, James Balich. Now, as John mentioned, the invasion of Auckland, he denies it. He denies it emphatically. He says that Māori had no intention of invading Auckland because the trade was just too good. They were trading with Auckland City. What the invasion of the Waikato was a defensive war. That would be precisely because there were pā sites built at Rangiriri, and what Governor Grey had done is he marched two-thirds of the British Army down Great South Road to attack the Waikato for land acquisition. Nothing more. It wasn't to help the natives. It was just for greedy land acquisition. Now, I know about John's obsession with Saparana Nata, which he's actually taken Saparana Nata's life out of context and cherry-picked out bits of his life that are appealing to him. I like to present James Fitzgerald. Now, James Fitzgerald was a Pākehā man, and he was born in the United Kingdom. And I got this this information out of the Parliament debates on November 5th of 1863, and this explains in depth that Māori had no idea that they were going to be invaded in the Waikato. I'll read it out. "This, sir, is proposed to be done. This great, what I call, this enormous crime is proposed to be perpetrated against a race whom have been refused the right of representation in this house, who at this moment are totally and absolutely in ignorance that we are about to make this great invasion upon their privileges. I'll go forward. I know that it has been, and it has sometimes been said, that the policy which has been advocated by one party in this country has been a policy dictated solely by the desire to acquire lands for the settlers. I object to this upon the grounds that these two grounds, I object first upon the ground that it is contrary to the Treaty of Waitangi, which distinctly guaranteed and pledged the faith of the Crown that the lands of the natives shall not be taken from them except by the ordinary process of the law, that is, taken within the meaning of the treaty. Lastly, again I object because I conceive the provision to be in direct opposition to the section of Constitution Act which debars us from making any law which is repugnant to the law of England." So what he's done there is he's described that in the first section that Māori have no idea they're about to get invaded. Secondly, what he's also said is that the people who are voting in Governor Grey have voting him for a single purpose is to grab land for themselves. It's land acquisition. It's nothing more. These ideals of queen and country are just rubbish. It's land acquisition.
A corporation financing John Key because they want to acquire power companies or something.
And lastly, the land acquisition was illegal because it was inconsistent with the Constitutions Act. Now, in the Treaty of Waitangi, Māori had been guaranteed they were British subjects under British law. So that in the Constitutions Act of England, the state is not allowed to procure private land. So all of this history that is being told by Martin Dutry and John and the NZCPR and all these other organisations, and that single statement debunks all of that information.
What do you make of this? Is this visible?
Yep, that's visible.
This is the amount of land that was sold willingly by Māori before 1840, the whole South Island and a fair chunk of the North. You know, that's the thing. Of the 25 million acres or whatever it is, acres, I think, hectares of New Zealand, about 23 million was happily sold. You see, Māori were not sheep farmers. They didn't know about making money from trees or sheep. Their surplus land was surplus land. It was just so many trees. They were using a certain part of it, and the rest of it, if they could get a buck for it, which they weren't using, damn right they were going to, and they did, in large numbers. Now, so you're putting up some guy called Fitzgerald. I'm not, I don't have a view on him. I don't know of him. I'm putting up the greatest Maori statesman of all time. That's why he's so embarrassing. That's the conclusion he came to. You can always find, as you and I are both doing, we can always cherry pick the person that suits us. We can always find someone to back up our claim. One random pom, and you're spoken like a true Brit, which I presume you are, called Joe Trinder. I'm sure you have a lot of my kind of blood there.
I'm actually Irish, John.
Yeah. Irish. So many. Yeah. So the Irish and the Maori have a mutual hatred of the English.
Oh, yes, we do.
Very, very good at joining forces. And I know a Maori Irish woman. She's fantastic at it. But look, This is what is happening. We're arguing away. We're both doing quite well with our arguments. It all happened a hell of a long time ago. You know.
In fact, that's a good point, John.
So why are we still arguing? Why is one outfit claiming 15% of the population saying that they need to be 50% of the decision making? That's just plainly unfair today. This is the 21st century now. Whatever happened then is arguable from both sides. Now, this is why I'm standing up, I guess, because I just want people to know that there's another side. I win if people know there's another side to what's being said, because it's only one side that's been heard up to now.
If I may, you made the point that we're living in a socialist country now, John, which is basically socializing compensation to Māori, and I get that. It's the whole thing. We've got welfare and all of this sort of stuff. Comes from a very loving place, but in a lot of ways it can in fact be damaging. What I want to know is precisely how you would propose to help Māori if not for the current socializing programs that are being used.
Well, the same way as we help everybody else in our compassionate country. Everybody gets helped. I mean, this is another slide I was going to put up, so now is a good time because it relates to this. I tell the media whenever I get the chance, look, poll the public, especially since I know what the polls are going to say. Should all New Zealanders have the same rights?
Obey the same laws, vote on the same roll, help those in need because of their need, not because of their race.
That's the thing, because of their need, not because of their race. It's very important that we do that. Otherwise, you find that people who happen to have a smidgen of Maori, like, you know, some Irishman like Steve O'Regan, for example, who's only a Maori of convenience, you know, get ahead of the queue in the hospitals. That's just not fair. New Zealanders are a fair people. You know, we've got a fair democracy. We do help people in minority positions. Wasn't always so, perhaps. But it's vital that we have equal access to all of our resources. And that's all I'm asking for, really. When you get one person who might have to drop off the list but to make way for some Maori person just because they're Maori, that offends people.
Mm.
It's offensive. You know, that's not going to happen all that often, but that the principle of that is offensive.
Joe?
Well, there's good reason why this is happening, and it comes down to Article 2 of the Treaty of Waitangi, and it says in the Treaty of Waitangi, to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand and to the respective families and individuals thereof, the full and exclusive and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forests and fisheries and other properties. So basically what this means to me, it's everything between heaven and earth. From wind rights, water rights, you name it. That's pretty much what it is. And sure. And if it doesn't mean those things, then it's being confiscated. So,
can I ask, Joe, just on that point, do British citizens have those same rights or not?
No, it's to the people who signed up to the Treaty of Waitangi, their families.
So the British didn't sign up to the Treaty of Waitangi as well as the Māori, or?
No, it guarantees to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand and to the respective families. It doesn't. So what goes wrong here is people are misinterpreting the Treaty of Waitangi. They believe that when they get citizenship, so we could have someone jump off the boat from Syria or Iraq or some other exotic place. And the 534 chiefs that signed the Treaty of Waitangi, they just didn't sign it off to anyone who turned up here and got New Zealand citizenship. They made sure that they protected the interests of their families moving forward. And it doesn't matter about their blood quantum, whether they're 1/1,000,000th of a zillionth of Māori. It was that they were respective family members.
Right. Can I leap in here? Complete fabrication, that. You're relying on the so-called official version of the treaty, which bears no relation to the one that I say is the only one that counts, which is the Māori Tiriti. If you want to see what that meant, you look at the Littlewood draft that was found in 1989 and so effectively covered up. And you don't see any mention of forests and fisheries, and you see that it means all the people. It's with all the people of New Zealand. Now, we can argue about that, what that means. Joe would argue that all the people of New Zealand doesn't mean that. It means all the Maori people of New Zealand. Well, I think that's hugely debatable. I think there are certain principles. This gets me back to Belich as well. There are two principles. One is called Occam's razor. I'm not quite sure why. I'm not sure who Occam was or what his razor was about, but it's basically...
He was the inventor of Gillette.
If you're
joking, but...
If you're stuck for an explanation, you take the simplest one. And there's another principle, a historical principle of historians, that if you're stuck for who to believe, you take the historian that wrote about it closest to the time. Mm-hmm. So starting with Belich, we are supposed to discard the work of people like James Cowan, whose father fought in the wars, who interviewed a lot of people who were still alive from that time, and we're supposed to defer to the wishes of a lefty called James Belich. I worked for his father, former mayor of Wellington, Labour. Now, that doesn't prove anything. It just shows the political agenda. You're supposed to believe people like Dame Claudia Orange, who didn't even mention the Littlewood draft's discovery, despite the fact that she was the first historian to cite it, and she said at that time, oh, this will be tricky politically. But she didn't even mention that in her updated book about the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, to me, that omission says more than all the other words in the book put together about her agenda.
John, just remember that you're one of the few people in this country who chooses to talk about these things the way you do, namely because what happens in society when you talk about things that are not comfortable with people, that are offensive, that are in their face, you will draw a lot of heat and flack for it. And if you are employed and you can be fired from your position, that's often a reason why people will choose to omit certain things because they don't want to upset the apple cart.
And you become somewhat unemployable, believe me, I know. But I just can't remember why I was talking about Occam's razor, the simple...
The simple explanation about the Littlewood Treaty.
Look, I have to confess I've just lost...
You know what, actually, to right now is the perfect point to go take a WikiLeak and take a break. But, John, quickly finish your point.
Well, it's a question of which treaty we are talking about. And there are certain words in the Treaty of Waitangi, whichever version, that give Maori an excuse to inflate. Joe would have us believe that the Maori brought the British in on some sort of management contract to manage the country, which they would continue to own and get all the benefits from. And they'd own everything from the soil to the sky, and the Brits would get nothing, and that would be seen by Queen Victoria as totally proper. That's absolute nonsense. Of course they didn't. And you get that by distorting meanings of words like taonga. You go back to the dictionary current at the time, you find that taonga, as defined by Chief Hongihika, no less, meant property procured by the spear. Here it is. The inflation of the word taonga to suit Maori greed over time. It now means treasure and everything we take a shine to. You know, and I've done this one which says, Chief Hongihika saying, let us march on the Waitangi Tribunal and spear the 4G spectrum. This is the sort of nonsense. Maori have a wonderful sense of humour. Everybody loves it. And they're using their sense of humour and they're taking us all for a ride, and it's a big joke and it's time to stop.
If this debate was a cup of coffee, a kind of coffee bean, it would be a robusta. We'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Check out our sponsors on the homepage, and also bear in mind that this is a listener-supported broadcast that does not survive without your contributions. If you wish for content like this that at least allows people the platform to speak their truth, then please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood hasn't go ahead. Make my news. And go ahead, make a donation or start a subscription and a regular gifting today. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. And my very special guests tonight are diametrically opposed, as much in political ideology, historical context, and skin pigment. John Hansel and Joe Trinder, welcome back, gentlemen.
G'day. I wouldn't mind some of Joe's pigment.
Yeah.
Too white. It can be too white sometimes.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, we're talking about racism and this debate. And for me, it's starting to look like it's not actually a racial or a debate. It's actually more a political / historical debate, much along the lines of the persecution of Holocaust revisionists not too long ago. Would you agree with that, John?
I don't know about your last comment about the Holocaust, but I do think that this is an ideological debate. I think, Māoridom today, not so much a coherent race as an ideology, the Māoridom. The radical Māoridom is more of an ideology or a religion. The race, I don't know, races are all that relevant anyway. I mean, you get people of different skin colours in different countries. You get, Brits talking with African accents and so on. I mean, it's culture is a set of habits, and that's what we're talking about. It often coincides with skin pigment, where those people live in those places, but also they move around. I have a Taiwanese stepson who speaks like a Kiwi, and so his race is not as big a part of his identity as the habits that he has formed. Some of those habits are Kiwi now. So I think it comes down to politics. Joe's from the left, I'm from the right. We've got our points of view. And the race thing just sort of dovetails in there, but it's not a necessary part of our makeup, I don't think. It doesn't. But I do think that somebody on my blog said that they visited Dachau. This is some teacher guy who's making a complaint about the program on Native Affairs last week. He's complaining to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. And sort of by the way, he was saying, why do people stick to these views? Why do the Nazis not plead guilty at Nuremberg when they were obviously guilty? He said, he and the prison guard decided that it's because Nazism was such a big part of their identity that to deny it would sort of, their identity would evaporate. Now, I know it's bad taste to bring up that particular analogy. It's just sort of useful. But, looking at Annette Sykes, I mean, I think a big part of her identity would evaporate if she was not pushing the Māori barrow. Being Māori to her is a major part of her identity. Being Pākehā or being a British-descended New Zealander is not a big part of my makeup. I don't think about it much.
What you're describing, John, is cognitive dissonance. When somebody threatens your worldview, the likelihood is to ignore them and then attack them.
Yeah, I think that Māoridom have got such pride. The Māori Renaissance has been so successful. But it means that people see themselves, perhaps half of Māoridom, the ones that are on the Māori roll, see themselves as Māori first, second and third, and New Zealand next. Much of the rest of the population don't particularly think about their race. Now, arguably, that's because we're the sort of majority and, we're comfortable with that and we don't have to think about ourselves in any sort of desperate way. But I just think it's a little bit unhealthy to focus so much of one's identity on that particular aspect and all of the money and grubbing opportunities that go with it, because that's really what I think it's about. Money, not mana. Money before mana. Now, that will be very insulting to Joe, but, being the person I am, I'm putting it up there, that it is about, Māori have got the hang of this British law and they're using it for all it's worth. They're using it to reinvent the treaty and and go for the doctor on the law, on the legal front, and the bloody whites are giving it to them, and it's great.
Sorry for the interruption, guys, but we've got to be taking a break right now. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're speaking with Joe Trinder and John Ansell. And if I might say so, I've spoken to some Komatoa myself, and I asked him. He's no longer with us now, but I asked him if Māori have the equivalent to what Europeans have, an elite that basically govern over our people and fleece us for all we're worth and leave most of us out in the cold? And he said, absolutely.
Well, the chief structure was there, you know, and of course in English society there was the feudal structure, the lord of the manor and so on. Well, I think there's more of a carryover of that in Maori society. I don't know how they enjoy the communistic aspect. There's a tremendous feeling of family among Maori that many of us sort of envy, I think. Mm. But when it comes to the power and who controls the land and so on, you know, an individual, you know, capitalistically inclined Maori who just wants to get his share and do something with his land can't do it because that communism is still there. I don't know what – I tried to talk to Ella Henry in the green room the other day about that. She was defending it. If I was a Maori, I'd want my share. I'd want to be able to behave as an individual. But that's what people like me say, isn't it? This collective thing is all very well if you like your relations and the group. But if you're sort of out of whack, well, it could be extremely counterproductive, I would have thought. What do you think, Joe? I mean, this idea of collectively owning land, does that work for you?
Well, I notice that yous always talk about the Maori elite, and I'll put it to you, to yous, that I don't believe that there is a Maori elite. I think that the entrenched treaty hate industry is a gravy train designed by the 1% of the population that control 50% of the New Zealand economy. And what it's designed to do is work as a distraction so that here you have these evil Māori over here who are doing trying to get treaty settlements, and then you have this other group over here that no one's seen at all, that own 50% of the economy, and they're committing tax evasion of $10 billion when treaty settlements are only $1.2 billion drip-fed to 36 different iwi over a period of about 20 years. So an example of that is I can give of that John has been influenced by the 1% that control 50% of the economy is Lewis Crimp. He is definitely one of the 1%ers, and he's funding you, John. And there's no denying about that.
So do you believe, Joe, that there's no Māori 1%? There's nobody in Māoridom that is wealthy and hasn't got Māori's best interest at heart?
Okay, there's 1% of the population of New Zealand that control 50% of the economy, and there's no Māori in that 1%. That certainly ain't Māori. If you really wanted to be of service to your country, John, I would go and look at the 1% of the people that aren't Māori that control 50% of the New Zealand economy. That's where the true tax evasion is going on in this country. They're the real enemy of poverty. They're the parasites of poverty, those people.
Good speech. You didn't answer my question, but never mind. I got to say, this thing about Lewis Crimp, he's a very convenient man to put up. Yes, he gave me some money 2 or 3 years ago. It enabled me to work full-time on this for that particular period of time, and someone else did as well. And that's what people do in private enterprise. They ask people for money because the state's not going to give it to me when I'm criticising the state. But I'm certainly not – I don't have that money now, and I'm not asking for any more. Now, you were talking about the 1%. Now, people like John Key and that are giving this stuff to Maori. I don't know why you're saying that they're not, but the guys on the left are always at the rich. I mean, the rich are the people that provide all the jobs. You don't seem to see the connection there. But I don't defend the rich when they do badly. I just noticed that the rich do seem to be self-disciplined and live in nice houses and also extremely generous. You mentioned that man in Southland. Well, he's done a hell of a lot for Invercargill. You go down there and ask what Lewis Crimp's done for Invercargill. I'm not defending him particularly, but he gets a bad press. But he gives an awful lot of his money away, and so he's entitled to. This is just sort of resentment of people with money. People with money equate to people who found a way to do service to people and clip the ticket. You know, people without money generally haven't found a way to be of service to people and haven't clipped the ticket. You know, so let's not have any of that. I'm not even sure where you're going with that, so perhaps I'll stop because I've lost my thread of why you're bringing in the...
Are we able to go back to the Littlewood paper?
Yep.
Go ahead, Joe.
The Littlewood paper. Yep.
Okay, before the break, John was mentioning about the Littlewood paper, and I'll explain what the Littlewood paper is. This is it here. It's a scrap piece of paper that was found in Manurewa in South Auckland in 1989. It mysteriously turned up 1 year before the first treaty settlement. The Littlewood paper is being pushed by a chap called Martin Dutre, who is also running another conspiracy theory about pre-Māori Celtics. It was found by brother and sister John Littlewood and Beryl Needham. And it was originally designed for Clendon, who was the American consulate, and it was not supposed to end up in South Auckland. It was actually supposed to end up in Washington, D.C. But it's been investigated by the world's foremost expert in treaty historian, and that's Dame Claudia Orange.
Right.
She's travelled the entire world investigating the Treaty of Waitangi. John.
And yet she didn't mention it in her comprehensive book on the treaty. You know, if you were a credible historian and you'd found this document after 149 years that everybody knew had gone missing, even if you thought, it wasn't the document or you had some political agenda not to want to acknowledge that it was, you would mention it in your comprehensive book about the Treaty of Waitangi, but she didn't mention it at all, even though she was the person that first saw it. And the handwriting, which was transparently obviously that of James Busby, who everybody knows was the guy who wrote the final draft out, it took them 11 years before Dr. Phil Parkinson, acknowledged by accident in some sort of in-house journal, which Martin Dutre happened to find because he was at National Library at the time, that it was, in fact, Busby's handwriting. So that's that Occam's razor thing that I was talking about before. The simplest argument is usually the one. Now, the simplest thing that it was the Littlewood draft. It was dated the 4th of February, which is the date that everybody knows that the final draft was written. All that people like Dame Claudia and that fellow Loveridge, who was brought in to do the hatchet job on Martin's book, could say was that this seasoned British bureaucrat got the date wrong. Now, you know, the Occam's razor principle is that that's nonsense. The most likely explanation is that he got the date right, and it was the document that we say it is. Over to you, Joe. Have another go.
I want to ask who benefits. I mean, who benefits from the current treaty process as it is and who loses out? Do you know?
Well, can I respond to
Sure, go ahead. I'm
John
sorry.
There? We're hearing from John every day how there's historians, national historians, that he dismisses, like Paul Moon, and also Dame Claudia Orange and James Balich, and also Michael King. And we're hearing that all these professional historians that have dedicated their entire lives to an education in history, and also the professors in universities, that we need to dismiss them. Well, it astounds me. Why would we go and dismiss the foremost experts in these fields?
The reason why I would, John, if I might ask, is because historically the foremost experts have been wrong about absolutely everything, from disease to to politics. But
but Joe, you're making out that this is somehow outrageous that I'm doing it. Those people are the ones who negated the work of the historians that were closest to the action. They said, they can't be right because they're Anglo-centric. In other words, all of their lifetime spent doing diligent work. They had no agendas in those days. There was no treaty scam or industry. They just told it as it was. They are to be dismissed, and we, the new socialist historians, like James Bellich and Dame Claudia Orange and Paul Moon. I mean, Paul Moon said about the Littlewood document, it can't be a treaty because it wasn't signed. You know, what rubbish that is. I mean, we never said it was a treaty. We've always said it was a draft. Of course you don't sign a draft. It was a scrap of paper. You're absolutely right. It was a scrap of paper written after much consideration, after numerous drafts. The final draft was written down in Busby's handwriting on the 4th of February, taken across the bay where Reverend Henry Williams and his son translated it into Te Tiriti o Waitangi as best they could, and that's the document that was signed. But to put your point of view, you've got to go against these established principles of history writing. The principle of the simplest explanation is the best. You might be right, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, to what you're saying is that the establishment is always right. Why are you a member of Mana?
Well, I'm not saying that the establishment's right. I'm just saying that people wouldn't spend their entire lives at a profession to go and deceive the public on stuff they've worked on and travelled the planet doing and getting paid for as professors. They're not paid for by the New Zealand government to deceive the public. They do this because it's their passion in life. And then to come out with these fantastical theories that someone like Martin Dutre is who's got no law degree, just saw a couple of dints and a couple of rocks, and thinks that he knows more than professors, it just doesn't seem realistic.
That is an outrageous slur on Martin Dutre. I've come to respect that guy. I am as suspicious of conspiracy theorists as anybody else, so I ask them lots of questions. People like Martin Dutre, Ross Baker, I nibble away at the finer points of the Littlewood document or the Celtic stuff, whatever. They always come back, or he in particular, Dutre, always comes back with a cogent answer. He deserves respect, and he deserves to be responded to with more than just character assassination. When people respond with character assassination, that shows me that they are being dishonest and they don't have any answer to the guy's explanations. You know, we went up there with on Mount Albert on my birthday, the 21st of March, autumn equinox this year, and we watched the sun come up in a trench that was cut by the Patuparaiahe, according to Martin, according to the Kamatua who told it to him, right in the slot at Mount Wellington, right when it was supposed to. And he took them up there to do that. He took them all around Auckland to show them these things, and none of it appeared on the program. Why not?
Now, here's the other thing. Do you believe, Joe, considering you were the one who kind of suggested we have this debate, that the mainstream media is covering John and Martin Dutre's points perhaps in their full detail? Joe?
Hey, Joe.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, first off, when you look at Martin Dutre's conspiracy theory, and that's all it is, there's no reality in it. Because I used to be in the Royal New Zealand Navy. I've travelled, I've done some maritime travel. And the distance from Britain, where he's saying the Celtics come from at the time of Christ, is approximately 24,000 kilometres to start a civilization in a country. NASA have actually discovered that you need to have a minimum of 15 women on board for genetic variance, or else the people die the civilization will die off if it doesn't have genetic variance. But we live in the 21st century, and we've got a civilization that now has things like aircraft and ships and refrigerators, and we also have a great degree of medical knowledge. So back then, the Celtics were quite a primitive people. And what they didn't understand was there's things like malaria and also other diseases that you get when you go and travel long distances. Scurvy is a prime example. So they'll be reluctant to get out of the Atlantic Ocean and to get into the Pacific Ocean at the time of Christ. So the very first European to reach the Pacific Ocean was Ferdinand Magellan. He's not just challenging Māori history, New Zealand history, He's recreating European history. This is this whole fantastical history that that would change the world.
We mustn't challenge. We mustn't come up with new theories. You give credence to the Maori, the so-called indigenous Maori, who are really indigenous to the other side of the Pacific and did well to get here. You say that that's okay, but people can't come from further away on the same by the same means for some reason. I don't get into that. The Celtic stuff, I've read it. I've seen some books that are totally implausible, one called From the Ends of the Earth. It's just a ridiculous book. I think Martin would say so as well, purporting that, this is a little speck, as it must be New Zealand. It could have been Fiji. It could have been the Philippines. Same pictures repeated again and again and again. Just nuts. So I can make the distinction between that and what Martin has explained to me. I would just like someone to debate him fairly, not with put downs, and I'll be interested in the result, and I'll be happy to assess it. But he has done an enormous amount of work, and all you want to do is say, "Oh, it can't be real because it would require."
Because it's a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard M. Nixon, when he was being exposed by Woodward and Bernstein over the Watergate affair, said, "It's not true. They're just conspiracy theorists." He was later found out to be part of a conspiracy and a crook, which he also denied.
Of something being a conspiracy. I've been to a 9/11 thing, a very plausible-looking thing. I don't know. I'm bewildered. But I certainly know that they put up an awful lot of evidence. And they deserve to be respected, and they deserve to be negated. They deserve to be a two-sided debate on all these things. Not one person just saying, "Oh, it's too fantastic for me. I can't be bothered. I'm not going to listen. So I'll just call it a conspiracy theory, and that'll probably convince a number of people not to bother."
Not to mention, Joe, you made the point earlier that why would somebody spend their entire life devoted to a field of study just to mislead and deceive people? Mm. Which is precisely the exact same thing that Martin Dutre has done.
Well, no, it's not.
Well, not his entire life, but.
He doesn't have a history degree. He's never been through a university. He doesn't know how to tell the truth.
How to deceive. The academia has a bloody lot to answer for. I don't think anybody buys the argument just because you've been to university and become a trained parrot that you are somehow more intelligent than somebody else. Plumbers that I associate with are brighter than a hell of a lot of the graduates. The graduates have just submitted themselves to indoctrination. Now, that to me is not – I didn't hang around long at university, and I went back to tell them that a few years ago. I don't think just because someone's been to an indoctrination palace like Waikato University that they have any more claim on intelligence than anybody else. Arguably the reverse. People who conduct their own studies like Martin Dutre have, like I have, I think you can argue that they are probably more independent of mind, more open-minded than those that submit themselves to indoctrination into how to become a trained parrot, like those who go to New Zealand University. That's why New Zealand University's social science degrees are so poorly thought of, the worst in the OECD. It's because of this, this indoctrination program around the treaty as much as anything else.
Hmm. What's your response to that, Joe?
Well, Martin Dutre is he's an American immigrant here to New Zealand. And I think what his theories are actually based on is Anglo-Saxon racial superiority. And what confounds him is he doesn't accept that Polynesians, who were only probably 2,000 to 3,000 kilometres away, that island hopped from the Cook Islands to the Kermadecs to New Zealand and already had a proven knowledge on celestial navigation and... These are technologies that the Celtics didn't have. And what Dutre's not trying to prove, he's not trying to prove that they managed to get the journey here. What direction did they come from? Because if you've ever noticed the Pacific Ocean, it's blocked off by two large continents, North and South America, and also Africa, and also Australia to some degree. So if you'd spent the 3 years travelling here at 2 to 3 kilometres, don't you think you'd probably want to stop at one of the other large continents that are between here and New Zealand? So I just, there's no other evidence of the travel coming out here. There's no what you also have to have is what's called Māori have a Mongoloid bee skull, Celtics had a Caucasoid skull. There'll be some evidence lying around like pre-Tasman Caucasoid skull buried somewhere. So, you know, seeing a couple of dints and a couple of rocks, Māori could have done that. They're perfectly capable.
Right. So did Māori use bullhorns and worship sunrises and dig trenches to measure equinoxes and all of that kind of stuff? Because according to the many of the Kaumātua that Dutre has spoken to, that the Māori did do that and were taught those skills by the Patupaiarahe.
Well, if you know the Easter Islands and you've ever seen the Moya statues out there, the Polynesian race were very capable at designing rock art or large statues. They
maybe
knew
you
how
don't
to do
know
masonry.
Just how capable, Joe. They were recently excavated around. You know how they're just the heads? They excavated, and they're not just heads, bro. They're all the way down.
Hell's teeth, really?
They're like 3-4 times as tall as anybody thought. So however, whatever methodology we think they managed to do that now was still amazing and we still can't explain it. Imagine it 10 times as technologically advanced. Not to mention, Māori and 186 other cultures around the world have stories of a great flood that wiped everything out. So if there was an ancient civilization here, it would have been wiped out. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back. Don't you go anywhere.